Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on the... It's actually not live, it's pre-recorded. Let's not dick you around here. It's the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood isn't go ahead and make my news. And if you want to keep continuing to have that news made, please go to the homepage and make a donation or start up a subscription for as little as $5 a month in order to just keep the wheels running and basically, I volunteer and help all the activists all over the world as much as I can with any time that I have available. And all I need is basically a roof over my head, internet, gas in my car, and food in my belly to do so. And I will do it. And I have been for many, many years. My very special guest joining me now is Professor James Fetzer. Jim, welcome to the program.
Oh, Vinny. Great. Glad to be here. Welcome.
Can you give us a little bit of an update? Because I haven't spoken to you in a wee while, because there was a recent leak, I think, from WikiLeaks or Snowden or something, confirming what you've been saying for a number of years, that there were mini or micro nukes used in the destruction of the World Trade Center.
Well, yes, I'm delighted to hear that. Veterans Today is publishing the most recent articles on this subject, but I have 10 articles probably laying out the evidence. It's ironic, Vinny, because we have one of the most important sources of proof is from the U.S. Geological Survey's study of dust samples, which were far more varied and extensive than those that were relied upon by Stephen Jones, Kevin Ryan, Niels Harrod, and others to maintain that nanothermite had been responsible for the destruction of the towers. It appears that even if nanothermite had been used, and it doesn't have the explosive capacity to blow those buildings apart, to convert them into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, or to destroy them to or even below ground level, that it was done using a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes, which, just to offer one model, could have been so arranged where you can dial their radius to, say, 100 feet. The buildings were 200 feet and 8 feet on a side. If you locate them in the core columns in the center of the building, then they would have had a perfect opportunity, especially directed upward, to take out, for example, as an illustration, one 10-floor cube per second, so that in the case of the 110-story North Tower, if you begin in succession from the top, you'll blow the entire building apart in 11 seconds. With regard to the second, because the top three floors, three cubes, were tilted to the side and blown as one, that would have taken 9. That happens to correspond to the NIST's time estimates. But the fact of the matter is, Vinny, that they hung their hook on a collapse, which wasn't even physically possible. Given the design of the towers and the laws of physics, those buildings could not have collapsed. And had they collapsed, I mean, Building 7 actually did undergo a collapse, then we would have had a pile of debris equal to about 12% of the height of the original. In that case, it was 47 floors. It yielded a debris pile equal to about 5.5. In the case of the Twin Towers, it would have been on the order of 13 or more floors of debris, but nothing was there, Vinny. This is a very powerful evidence. USGS dust samples include barium and strontium, lithium, lanthanum, uranium. Tritium was found there as well. Among the very first studies that I published about this was based upon the Vancouver hearings held in June of 2012. It's entitled 9/11 Truth Will Out, the Vancouver Hearings 2, and you can find it online. But since then, we've had a succession of additional studies that corroborated, including evidence from a Russian intel dump that Gordon Duff, the senior editor of Veterans Today, has been publishing in his own columns.
And what's the actual significance of this? Because a whole lot of people in the movement have been like, oh, 9/11's been, it's done and dusted. And I think what Bill Hicks would say, well, then don't bring up Jesus to me, you know, as long as we're talking shelf life here.
Well, just to make the obvious point, the 19 Islamic fundamentalists who are hijacking these commercial carriers, according to the official myth of 9/11, couldn't possibly have arranged for mini or micro nukes to be distributed throughout the building. That require prior planning, the access to the buildings. The Twin Towers, along with the rest of the World Trade Center, only went into private hands 6 weeks before 9/11, when Larry Silverstein, took control, fired the security firm that had been handling since it opened in 1970, and hired Kroll Associates, an Israeli firm. So just as we had Israeli security at the different airports from which those planes allegedly departed, we had Israeli security at the World Trade Center. And in fact, there were a host of prominent figures who were adamant supporters of Israel involved in the transfer in the first place.
Now, on that point, I have just received a message from Dr. Kevin Barrett, who I think would actually really be great here, especially on the Israel element. Don't you think? So we're just
absolutely. It'd be great. Maybe you could have Kevin come on following me. That would be perfect.
Even better. We're going to have him on with you. And here he is coming on right now. You know, I mean, this is something that I tend to excel at, is just, you know, just doing things on the fly. Now, we have Dr. Kevin Barrett now joining us. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, good to be back with you, Vinny.
Now, what James was just saying, just to bring you up on it, was the amount of Israeli involvement, particularly security involved with the World Trade Center. And we started off the conversation by talking about Snowden's recent leaked information detailing the possible use of mini and micro nukes used in the destruction of the World Trade Center. And I thought you'd probably want to weigh in on this one.
Sure, yeah, it's an interesting question. I think it's less important precisely how these demolitions were accomplished than that there were demolitions. And, of course, that's been proved seven ways from Sunday, but the world hasn't fully digested that information yet. So I think the most important thing to do is to kind of hammer at the fact that these three skyscrapers were clearly blown up with some form of high explosive. And then the question of what form of high explosive it was is really secondary. But there is, you know, interesting evidence for nuclear weapons at the Trade Center. For me, not being a nuclear scientist and not really being qualified to assess these various claims, especially the ones that rely on supposedly classified mini hydrogen nukes and things like that, that even the nuclear scientists don't know about. But the evidence that is interesting to me is the photographs that we recently found. Veterans Today published them, showing the molten granite bedrock under the towers, you know, after 9/11 when they excavated down there. Boy, something, it sure looks like something just outrageously hot. A tremendous amount of heat must have melted all that bedrock. If you just look at those photos, you have to ask yourself what possibly could have done this. And based on, you know, what we know about physics and so on, the obvious answer would be a nuclear weapon.
Mm. And according to NIST, it was probably the Flintstones that melted bedrock because they had such an awesome party.
Yeah, Fred and Barney did it.
Well, I don't know, Fred. I think it might have been a nuclear bomb, eh?
Maybe it was Bam Bam. Bam! Bam! Bam!
It's just like Bam Bam creates squibs. Bam! 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 Bam!
Yeah, that's Vinny, what those firefighters
said,
wasn't it?
Just to expand on the theme, Gordon has explained how the Israelis seem to come in possession of nuclear warheads by being given 35 howitzer nuclear warheads in the George W. Bush administration, took them back to Israel, refined them, and then brought them back into New York City by way of submarine, where they were, their presence was detected by Russian satellites because of their gamma radiation, and then they were used to take out the Twin Towers. And of course, in addition to the them having the power to blow apart those buildings, as I have been describing, and in addition to the U.S. geological dust samples, we have what turned out to be some 70,000 New Yorkers who have suffered from the kinds of ailments: multiple myeloma, esophageal, pancreatic cancer, lymphoma, and so forth, that are associated with exposure to ionizing radiation. So we know, you know, we have multiple evidential indicators, including, of course, these spectacular photographs of beneath where the towers had stood that seemed to indicate some massive, powerful explosions were detonated in that vicinity.
The one part that was very telling to me is the top of, I think it was World Trade Center 1, the one with the spire on the top, unlike Trade Center 2, how the top actually fell sideways and then just disappeared, right? It literally kind of poofed into vaporized dust before it even hit the ground. Well, how was that even physically possible?
Well, actually, there are photographs of what appears to be the remnants of the tower itself, Vinny, so that, it's a very fascinating puzzle to unpack, but it seems of the alternative theories, the only one that seems to hold together and provide the highest probability upon the available evidence is the use of mini or micro nukes, probably neutron bombs. Where the use of these very sophisticated weapons is very instructive because it rules out almost anyone except, very sophisticated military sources, in particular the U.S. or, in this instance, Israel, because we had provided them to Israel, leaving out, of course, the Chinese, the Russians, and so forth, who obviously had nothing to do with 9/11.
Kevin, do you believe that there's an Israeli hand in 9/11? And the question I would ask is why? Why would they do it?
Yes, I think there was an Israeli hand. In fact, I think 9/11 is best viewed as a kind of a hardline Zionist coup d'etat in the USA. And the question of why is pretty easy to answer, which is that Israel is in a very difficult position in terms of its long-term or even medium-term sustainability. Henry Kissinger famously said there wouldn't be any Israel 10 years from now. That was a few years ago when he said it. He may have been exaggerating and trying to scaremonger and scare up some money from the usual funders, but I do think that the Israelis know that they're in a very bad situation. They've been conducting themselves so viciously since they genocidally occupied Palestine, slaughtered whole villages full of people, expelled most of the rest of the Palestinians, that nobody in the Middle East considers them a legitimate country. And they have a birth rate that's lower than that of the surrounding Arabs. And they basically feel that they're going to have to keep expanding and taking more and more territory in order to survive and stay in a permanent state of war. And of course, that's creating more and more opposition. So they feel like they need extraordinary measures to try to sustain Israel as an apartheid Jewish state. And I think 9/11 was one of those extraordinary measures. It was designed to create deep-seated hatred of Israel's Arab and Muslim enemies that would take the war to West, take the West to war, against the enemies of Israel for the next century. And that was the real, it wasn't the New American Century. Project for a New American Century was a disguise. They just rewrote the clean break plan that was drafted by Benjamin Netanyahu in 1995-96. Netanyahu's people went and turned around and rewrote that document, which was about how to bust up the neighbors of Israel so Israel could survive. And they changed it to make it as though it were ostensibly to help the American empire last for another 100 years. But what it really is about is taking down Israel's enemies, changing the game in the Middle East, breaking these countries up into pieces, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what 9/11 was meant to do, was to essentially put these hardline Zionists in control in the U.S. and in the West and allow them to use the power of the U.S. and the West to wage endless war against the enemies of Israel.
So much like every other false flag throughout history that's been documented, it's pretty much a self-inflicted wound in order to blame a specific enemy, which is politically convenient to do, and also make a whole bunch of people rush into the recruiting stations to die for somebody else's money and power.
And we have further confirmation from Wesley Clark, who, after he returned from serving as Supreme Commander Allied Forces Europe, which is to say the commanding officer of NATO, he was had an encounter with a general in the Pentagon who told him that we were first going to plan to go to war with Iraq, which baffled him. He said, "Why?" And the general said, "I don't know." He says, "I guess we're just good at it." So Clark was baffled that we were even going to attack Iraq, which everyone knew had nothing to do with 9/11. When he returned months later and encountered the same general, he asked, "Are we still planning to attack Iraq?" And the general said, "Oh, sir, it's even worse now." He said, "I just received this memorandum from the Secretary of Defense that we're going to take out the governments of seven countries in the next 5 years." And again, he was dumbfounded about this. It was going to begin with Afghanistan, Iraq, and wind up with Syria and Iran, which, of course, is not an Arab country, but it was on the hit list. And he recollected a conversation he'd had years before with Paul Wolfowitz, who was Assistant Secretary of Defense at the time.
Wasn't he the former head of the World Bank as well?
Yeah, he would get that afterwards, about going into the Middle East and creating chaos so we could take it under control. But, of course, that wasn't the idea at all, as Kevin has been sketching. The idea was to deconstruct the modern Arab states and set them out from their secular governments, which had been holding them together, as had Saddam Hussein and Assad now is manfully struggling to keep his country together, because there would be an inevitable tension between the conflicting sects of Sunni, Shia, and Kurd. In the case of Iraq, for example, is a most obvious illustration. And it was therefore really to do the dirty work on behalf of Israel to advance its agenda to create the greater Israel dominating the entire region from the Tigris-Euphrates to the Nile.
Is Israel, of course, just a puppet themselves of the global bankers and whatnot, or is there actually a national agenda within the Israeli government, and they have that kind of power through the use of Mossad and other ruthless tactics in order to actually keep their influence going, or are they merely one piece on the chess board that the globalists are using? Now, before you answer that, I also wanted to clarify something here, because there's been a lot of anti-American sentiment in New Zealand, talking about mass surveillance. We have the NSA that is set up in our local kind of CIA variant called the GCSB building, and also the TPPA, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is going to bind, I think, nearly 10 or 11 countries or something like that into these massive corporate trade deals and agreements, which will, in fact, destroy New Zealand and all of those involved countries' abilities to write their own laws if it impedes the will of these globalist corporations. And I wanted to actually stress the point that it is not Americans or America that is actually doing this. It's merely being used as a vessel, a tool, a puppet, if you will, in order to basically project military and corporate dominance across the world and to blame the people of the United States for something the globalists are influencing. I think it's kind of missing the mark. Would you agree?
I think you're basically right, Vinny, and Kevin can add his additional reflections here, but it seems to me the Rothschilds bankers were equally eager to get into the Middle East, because there is an eschewing of usury in Islam so that they'd never been able to get a foothold. I remember being struck when the rebel group in Libya out to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi, its first act was to found a new central bank. As soon as I heard that, I realized this was not at all as it was being portrayed to be. Kevin.
Yeah, you know, getting back to Vinny's question, I think that there may be a kind of agenda among some of the banksters behind the New World Order to put the capital of their New World Order in Jerusalem. That's the thesis of Imran Hossein, who's probably the greatest Muslim scholar cum geopolitical analyst. And he argues that a kind of perversion of Judaism, you know, has taken this idea of the people going back to the promised land and has, you know, believes in taking back everything that God gave to the tribe and then taking over the world and putting the capital there. And he, Imran Hussein, thinks that that's actually going to happen. Many other scholars who've looked into this, including some Israelis, there's that Israeli journalist, Barry Chamish, who says that these are not Jews. These are sort of Donmei heretics, people who were followers of the false Messiah, Shabbatai Zeve, several centuries ago. He tried to lead a return to the promised land among Jews of the world, and he had a huge following. He was arrested. He converted to Islam to avoid the death penalty. And there's been all of his followers converted as well. They pretended to be Muslims, and many of those people are now involved in running Turkey and its deep state, narcotics trafficking, finance, And it's said that the royal family of Saudi Arabia may also be Dahmei Jews. And so these people are actually not really Jews, though. They're Satanists. They have sexual orgies as their religious rituals and conduct human sacrifices. According to Barry Chamish, the Israeli investigative reporter, they took over the Rothschild family, took over Freemasonry, the Illuminati, et cetera, et cetera, in the late 18th century, and consolidated power in global finance. And according to Imran Hussein, these are the people who want to put the new world capital in Jerusalem. And he says to do it, they're going to create a world war. Out of that world war, they hope that Israel will be kind of the last power standing. They'll have control over the energy resources of the Middle East, and they will overtly establish a kind of a world capital or a new hegemon in greater Israel, which, of course, will be Nile to Euphrates Israel, not the Israel of today. Now, whether or not all of this is true, clearly there are people in Israel, Zionists, who want this and who believe in it. It seems that many of the founding fathers of Zionism were planning on taking all of Eretz Israel, greater Israel, meaning Nile to the Euphrates, and totally dominating the Middle East and perhaps the world. So, yeah, I think that there's an intersection between a certain agenda of at least some of these globalist banksters and the state of Israel.
And how does that actually make you feel as a follower of Islam personally? I mean, do you feel like your religion's under attack or what?
Well, yeah, not just my religion, but if indeed this is all true, there's actually a kind of a cosmic struggle of good versus evil going on. It sounds goofy and mythological, and it's not the kind of thing that secular intellectuals these days like to even entertain. But I think that actually just closely observing what's going on in the world, as people like Imran Hussein do, can convince you that this may be the case, that the Zionist movement has been so mendacious and so vicious and so powerful and so good at disguising its power, pretending to be the victim while it's actually the victimizer. There is something really creepy and satanic about this. Islam is, it's about submission to God, and everybody who submits to God is a Muslim with a small M. That would include Christians, Jews, even some Hindus and Buddhists and Native American and whoever else. And so if indeed the Holy Land is under occupation by Satanists, this as a Muslim and as Christians and everybody else who cares about goodness should be upset about this. And obviously it's going to lead to trouble, that this Holy Land has been taken over by people who are this nasty and deceptive and satanic. That can't be good, whatever your nominal religion.
It matters not whether or not you believe in Satanism or Islam. The point is there are people out there who do believe it. And they will act, and those actions will affect you. Now, that's whether or not they are acting with good intentions or with good actions. And I'm sure that in a lot of ways, good intentions and good actions aren't necessarily the exact same thing.
Yeah, that's true. I think that there are plenty of people, including Zionists and Israelis, who have good intentions within their old worldview. And indeed, the Americans who marched off into Iraq and slaughtered hundreds of thousands of people, maybe over a million in this latest war, probably had good intentions in many cases. They thought they were bringing freedom and democracy to Iraq. And the Nazis who killed so many people, however many, the total number and whatever ethnicity and whatever method of execution they may have used, which Jim, I'm sure, would have a lot to say about, those people probably had good intentions within their own worldview as well. Most people do, perhaps even the Satanists. I think a lot of Satanists think that Satan is the liberator and, God is the tyrant. So within people's own worldviews, they tend to find some way of approving of their own actions.
Now, I'm sorry, guys, we're going to have to quickly take a break here. Are you both free for the next 25 minutes or so to do one more segment?
Sure.
Okay.
We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. It's a listener-supported broadcast, so if you go there and donate or start to subscribe regularly for $5 a month, we'd really appreciate it, and it allows us to bring you radio like this. Damn, this is awesome. We'll be right back.
Listen, damn it. You step outside, you risk your life. You take a drink of water, you risk your life. And nowadays you breathe, and you risk your life. Every moment now, you don't have a choice. The only thing you can choose is what you're risking it for. Now, I can make these people feel better and hang on a little bit longer. I can save lives. That's reason enough to risk mine. And you know that.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the final segment of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's a bit of an impromptu broadcast today. We have Professor James Fetzer and... wait a second. Kevin, aren't you a professor too?
Well, I was a professor at Kaplan University for a while. I was a lecturer at UW-Madison, and I've had various titles at various higher education institutions. So you can call me professor if it pleases you.
All right. Well, you tend to profess things. It's sort of come with the job.
Okay. Okay, I'll profess. I'll profess to profess.
I'll confess to professing. Okay. Anyway, Jim, you were saying something about this religious aspect.
Yeah, you want to bear in mind that Barack Obama encountered a problem with the public when he wanted to lob cruise missiles into Syria in response for the gas attacks, which were being assigned to this Syrian government, but in fact came from the rebels. Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia may well have been the supplier in that instance. But the American public was outraged, even if they had come from Assad, that Obama was going to get us involved in yet another war. The cruise missiles would have killed many more people than the gas purportedly had. It would have been another violation of a nation's sovereignty, in this instance Syria. And by a ratio of on the order of 99-1, the American people said absolutely not, no, and it was defeated. Therefore, they had a marketing problem of how to advance the agenda of finishing off Syria and then before turning to Iran, which led to the inspired concoction of the Islamic State, which really is a merge of Al-Qaeda and other efforts together with support from the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia. So we now have this new menace, which is being used to justify American attacks, even in Syria, allegedly to stop ISIS. But the fact of the matter is, as Alan Zabrowski has observed, we're bombing the infrastructure of Syria, including grain silos, oil refineries, bridges, and the like, which are intended to leave him far weaker than he was absent those attacks. Victoria Nuland, on a recent interview on national television, admitted we were not there to stop ISIS. We were there to undermine Assad. We have a U.S. general who, by the name of Vallali, who's actually advising them. The EU ambassador to Iraq admits the EU is buying oil from ISIS. The U.S. is spending $200 million every week, both supporting and attacking ISIS, meaning we're feigning at least to be attacking it, but really seeking to undermine Assad, where most tellingly this whole Khorasan group was invented out of thin air to pose some imminent threat to the United States. I'm sure Kevin was just as baffled as I when it first made its entry, with Obama solemnly intoning that we have this imminent threat. It's rather clear that this was a way to circumvent the United Nations Charter, which dictates that one country cannot attack another unless it has approval of the Security Council, with the sole exception that it confronts an imminent threat. So out of thin air, they spun up the Khorasan group to be an imminent threat to justify what we're doing, even though it's in violation of the UN Charter. And
well, what I seem to happen here is that they make these rules and they build in loopholes, kind of like the way the Obama administration built in loopholes for the the insurance companies, the health insurance companies, when passing Obamacare. Incidentally, Obamacare was written by, you guessed it, the insurance companies. And it's this exact same kind of cynical, nihilistic scumbaggery process by which they can more or less break their own laws ad infinitum and never be charged for them, because even if they did break a law and get caught for it, they also have the ability to change laws retroactively to make breaking the law legal and then continue to break it anyway.
It's absurd. You know, Vinny, anyone just listening to what you said would say that's preposterous. You know, no one could make that up. But in fact, that's been what has happened with the recent history of the United States. It's deplorable. It's appalling. I have never been more ashamed of the United States than when it demonstrates hypocrisy of the degree to which it's displaying it today. Duplicity, deception, lies, lies, lies. We're getting nothing but lies. I mean, from Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing to the Ebola hoax to what's going on in Africa to the Ukraine and the Middle East. I mean, it's all a pack of lies. It's absolutely unbelievable. You can't get any truth from the government anymore at all. And a recent weakening of the Smith-Mundt Act, of which you may have never heard, but it was a legislation from 1948 that precluded the use of propaganda techniques by the American government on the American people, was vitiated by the National Defense Appropriations Act of 2013, which means now there's no holds barred on spreading false information and deliberately deceiving the American people about domestic or foreign affairs.
Like Jim Dean says, you can't make this stuff up, but they can. You know, it was Karl Rove who lashed out at the reality-based community, said, we're an empire now. We create our own reality. And while you reality-based idiots are out there trying to figure out what we've done, we're going to be way out ahead of you, creating new realities. And that's the way it's going to play out from now on. You know, we're history's actors, and you're just going to be trying to figure out what we do.
This reminds me exactly of what I think it was Mark Twain who said, that the problem with fiction is that it has to make sense. Nonfiction doesn't.
Yeah, it makes less and less all the time.
He made a lot of astute observation, including that it's easier to fool a person than to convince him that he has been fooled, which is part of the problem with trying to reveal the deceptions of 9/11, Sandy Hook, Boston bombing, what's going on in the Ukraine and the Middle East.
I wanted to make a point here about the last century in America. You've gone from 10% growth in the economy per year under a non-central banking cartel to progressive taxation and a private central bank, and you've gone from being the most intelligent, literate, morally backboned citizenry in the history of the world to the laziest, dumbest, most capitulating human trash that has ever existed. And this is the deliberate agenda of a evil group of scumbags who know that all the goodness that was America needed to be destroyed in order for them to rule it.
I wish I could disagree with
you. The American middle
class
was their biggest obstacle in the path of the New World Order.
That's right. So you had to vitiate the middle class, and NAFTA and the WTO did a pretty good job of that. But you're absolutely correct, Vinny. In the most recent ranking of economic freedom, as recently as 2000, the United States stood second in economic freedom here, which is a function of the rule of law and of the maintenance of property rights and freedom from corruption. We've now sunk. We are 12th, tied with the UK in only a few years, and it's got all to do with this loss in property rights, freedom, corruption, and the control of government spending. We have lost the rule of law, and why this is so terribly important is that economic freedom is really a close facsimile of what's known as effective freedom, meaning, freedom. Everyone has the right to sleep under bridges and eat from garbage cans if they want. But effective freedom is what you can do with the resources at your disposal. The reason the rich are actually freer than the poor is because they have more effective freedom. They have more resources to buy yachts, sail the world, you know, travel, whatever, live a certain lifestyle, buy expensive automobiles. So this diminution in economic freedom, although most Americans wouldn't grasp the concept at all, really is a very serious matter. And the fact is that the loss of the rule of law has gone so far that we now have even a recent article from the Washington Post about agencies, and these include agencies like police agencies, the FBI and the DEA, are conducting raids on homes and taking possession of property. I have a good friend who was a former top psychiatric consultant to the FBI, of all people, a prominent psychiatrist in Washington, D.C., who was targeted by the DEA. They took his three automobiles, his three computers. They froze his bank account, allegedly because he had $100,000 there from dealing drugs. Well, he wasn't a drug dealer. He had that for medical equipment. But it turns out the way the law is written now, they can appropriate all of your possessions. with no due process whatsoever, and you have to go to court to prove that you own them to regain control of them. Ironically, in his case, he was notified a year later that he had received a speeding ticket from Montgomery County for one of the vehicles the DEA had appropriated, which they'd been using to joyride, a ticket for $80. I mean, talk about adding insult to injury for vehicles that they'd taken possession of a year before.
Now, the reason why I made that analysis of that the last century being the fall of America, I believe, comes down to one man, and one man only, who triggered it all and allowed this to happen, Edward Bernays, the man who literally created propaganda and public relations. And if you have a look at anything that the United States government does today, it is all propaganda, it is all public relations, none of which would have been possible or as effective without that man.
Well, that's right. You know, a more accurate term for it is mind control. Public relations is really a euphemism. What it's about is affecting people's thought and behavior below the level of consciousness. And that's evil. You know, it's like if I try to convince you to do something or believe something, if I engage you rationally and consciously and we debate it, that's fine. But if I use special techniques to try to implant things into your mind that you're not aware are there, that will govern your thoughts and behavior, that's evil. That's mind control. And that's what Bernays invented, using the discovery of the unconscious by Uncle Sigmund Freud to do that. And today it's so out of control. People are walking around, you know, like brainwashed lemmings. They don't understand why it is that the thought of what may have really happened on 9/11, even looking into that question, generates so much fear. Well, they had something implanted deep in their minds by the traumatic, the mind control event of 9/11. Same thing with the Nazi Holocaust. Even talking about what did and didn't happen during the Nazi Holocaust sends spasms of fear up and down the spine of most people for reasons that are completely unconscious. They couldn't possibly articulate what's going on in their own minds. And these are just a couple of examples. Actually, people's entire way of life and their consciousness, their actions are all being governed by these mind controllers. So, yeah, really, Bernays created puppet strings to the unconscious minds of the mass public and greatly degraded humanity and degraded the human soul.
I do believe this is absolutely the case, and I think it's evidenced by the fact that most people think Bernays is some form of condiment that you put on a sandwich with lettuce.
Well, that sounds tasty. You could probably put an ad with a really delicious-looking sandwich and convince me to eat some Bernays on it, you know?
I mean, you know, what could go wrong?
Bernays brand sandwich spread.
Coincidentally, I'm in contact with Gordon because I've been having trouble getting onto Veterans Today, and someone had written me and that how they'd been unable to make access. So I asked him about it, and it turns out that Veterans Today has been hacked because of an article Gordon wrote exposing about Ebola and the whole hoax involved here, and that pretending that Homeland Security hasn't trained thousands in bioterrorist seminars costing billions of dollars explain you can only control Ebola at level 3 quarantine. You can't do it with duct tape and paper jammies. And how we have a story now about what you do when someone with Ebola throws up on you as a healthcare worker. You leave work, get on a plane for Cleveland. He's saying an estimated 5,000 Americans have been exposed already. But, you know, the whole thing is simply completely ridiculous.
I'm getting sick of this whole. I'm getting sick of this whole endless pandemic thing. You know, it's bird flu, dog flu, camel flu, Ebola. I mean, what's going to be next? And that's basically it. When it comes out, it's a seasonal thing, and there's some kind of disease. Incidentally, every single disease that had basically ever been classified as a global pandemic winds up having some kind of Department of Defense contract or patent on it or whatever. And then incidentally, the Department of Defense, who owns a huge chunk of most of the major pharmaceutical companies or whatever, at the very least in some way is influencing and controlling them, winds up getting a whole lot of money as all these stupid people go out and rush to get their vaccines, which are full of deadly chemicals that they don't even know the names of because there aren't even any ingredients on the frickin' packets.
So you're not lining up to get the Ebola vaccine, Vinny?
I would rather line up to an execution stand.
Yeah, well, that may be what you're doing. If you get the Ebola vaccine, it may be the Ebola is in the vaccine. I mean, the Ebola was first discovered in Africa in the 1970s. Now, in the intervening decades, and we've had quite a few of them up until now, it has not become a major problem, even though their standards of hygiene and sanitation are grossly inferior to what we experience here in the Western nations. I mean, there's something here that just doesn't add up. And it's pretty clear that this is intended to instill fear into the American people, possibly as a potential justification for imposing martial law. They've been looking for something to do this for a long time, it seems to me, and this may be one more gambit to see if the American people will fall for it.
I think they're just trying to keep the pot boiling. It's the politics of fear. You know, that BBC documentary, The Power of Nightmares, got it right. The politicians used to rule using hope, telling you that vote for us and you'll have a better life. Now there's no more hope for a better life, so they're ruling with fear. 9/11 was the big event of this new age of the politics of fear. But to get 9/11, they had to do some false flags before that, African embassy bombings, USS Cole. And then to keep the pot boiling after 9/11, they had to do some more false flags. And along with the false flags, they come up with some disease scare every year or two. Like you said, Vinny, it was the bird flu, and then it was this, it was that, now it's Ebola. I don't think that Ebola is going to be capable of generating any major epidemic. Probably thousands of times more people will die of flu this year than will die of Ebola. But, hey, it's sexy. People are bleeding out every orifice. That's great. Yeah, vomiting, projectile vomiting and bleeding out every orifice. This makes wonderful fear propaganda. So I think they're just trying to keep the propaganda pot boiling.
I saw a great picture the other day that says, what's the difference between love and herpes? Herpes is forever.
Well, Gordon is even saying that the disease is not actually communicable. But, you know, Vinny, you were speaking of dismay with your PM. What did you think about David Cameron announcing that 9/11 truthers and 7/7 critics should be handled the same way, dealt with as harshly as ISIS? I mean, what's he planning to do?
That was hilarious.
It's unreal.
I thought that he should be on the Vinny Eastwood show.
So people who are opposed to government terrorism are the worst kind of terrorists, just like the terrorists that the government funds.
Is that I mean, we're cutting people's heads off.
Did I miss something?
Kevin and I have this great friend in the UK by the name of Nick Kohlerstrom, who actually, recognizing that he was both a 9/11 truther, a critic of 7/7, he's actually published the leading book on entitled Terror on the Tube, now in its fourth edition, exposing the hoax that was 7/7. He took himself down to Scotland Yard and said he wanted to report terrorism and that he had a bit of evidence. He brought a copy of his book along to Scotland Yard. They refused to arrest him, but I thought it was a marvelous, you know, exposure of the absurd position adopted by the PM of the UK.
I'm a nonviolent extremist. Please arrest me before I commit nonviolent extremism again.
Well, it's as though Cameron doesn't understand the difference between thought and action. I mean, this is as absurd as it gets.
Oh, dear God, he's nonviolent. Boom!
Vinny, is it that bad down in your neck of the woods? I mean, really?
Oh, mate, what's been happening now, the Prime Minister's been who used to work for Merrill Lynch and has shares and still has shares in the Bank of America, which New Zealand still loans money off, mind you, has been saying that there's Al-Qaeda terrorists in New Zealand and all sorts of other stuff. He's passed draconian surveillance legislation amidst massive uproar to the country, and everybody is like, well, actually it violates this law and that law and that law and that law and that law to in order to pass that one law. And so he goes, well, fuck it, I'll just do it anyway, and then change all the laws retroactively. So it basically, what I've come to conclude is that, and I also want to reference back to my analysis of America in the last 100 years and its fall and descent. It is not just you guys. My country is always has also turned into fat, lazy, unthinking, unsuspicious, easily manipulated, herdable sheep, which is even worse considering there's like 40 million sheep in this country and 4 million people. One could argue that there's actually 44 million sheep.
Is it something in the water, Vinny? You know, Lancet
we
is
do have,
to...
uh, we do have Lancet fluoride.
Is, no, listen, Lancet has finally declared that fluoride actually is a neurotoxin in areas where it's the water is heavily fluoridated. The children lose, you know, appreciable IQ points as a consequence. So it may be your country has been massively fluoridated for so long, it's finally taking its toll.
If a man gets shot by the police and then runs into a burning house and then inhales smoke and then gets stabbed by somebody else who's in that burning house and then gets a giant air conditioning unit fall through the floor and land on him, what killed him? All right. See, there's the argument saying that fluoride's the result of the vanishing IQ. In actual fact, everything is. There's so many influential factors. I mean, and let's not underestimate, again, the power of the media through which basically fluoride would have never been justified, because if you have a media that does things like, I don't know, fact check anything that they say before they actually say it, or maybe check up on what a politician's statement is before reporting it mindlessly, word for word, right? If they were to do any of that, if there was any such a thing as journalism truly in the mainstream media, all of these things that we talk about, all of these things that we are concerned about, would not be a concern. The only reason why corruption is allowed to grow is because people are not concerned about it, and thus it can continue to grow exponentially. Corruption's kind of like cancer. It has an exponential growth curve, and it will only die once it kills the host, or once the host kills it.
Jeez, that sounds like nonviolent extremist talk there, Vinny.
Killing corruption is not killing a human being. It is not hurting a person. It is simply exposing that which others do not wish to be seen. And as I think it was Orwell that said, if you, a journalist's job is to report that which people don't want you to report. Everything else is public relations, which, as Kevin so eloquently stated before, is mind control.
Well, geez, really nice Vinny, you know, your brand of nonviolent extremism is probably the worst. I mean, it is just like ISIS, because you're a nonviolent humor extremist, and you make people laugh their heads off.
Well, you know, you got to look on the lighter side of genocide, and I think that there is actually this element here there where wars only happen and keep going when people lose their sense of humor about it. All right. Basically, that's about the end of it. And if you think about the Israel-Palestine conflict, for interest, how many jokes do you reckon are coming out about that? Nothing.
The lighter side of the Israel-Palestine conflict, that sounds like a good idea for a book.
Exactly. I came up with a couple of jokes. I'll share you my Israeli jokes, and then we've unfortunately, I've got to go. I've got about 2 minutes before my next broadcast comes up with the Man Talk project. But what I wanted to say was, why are Israelis suspicious of chickpeas? Because they could be working for Hamas. And also, this is the reason why you don't take Israelis out for Turkish kebabs, because they'll shoot at the Hamas. And how do Israeli tank crews greet Palestinian children? By saying shalom. Mm.
Shalom indeed.
That's serious nonviolent humor extremism there, Vinny. But you know.
Hey, it may be serious, but it's definitely not very Assad.
I love the lighter side of genocide.
Hey, you know, just because we're being enslaved and ruthlessly criminally dominated by the worst human trash that have ever existed on the planet Earth doesn't mean we can't have a few laughs about it, eh? Otherwise, the terrorists win.
I think laughter can transmit Ebola, Vinny.
Yeah.
You have to be careful.
Well, I think you can transmit it through radio waves or something like that. I'm going to look. In fact,
oh God, turn your radio off now.
In fact, here's the I'm just going to give you Ebola now, ladies and gentlemen. Ebola, Ebola. There we go. You've all now got it. Thank you very much, Jim.
Our pleasure.
And thank you very much, Kevin.
You, Vinny. I'm not bleeding out all of my orifices yet, but I think the ears are starting to itch.
Just wait. You know, it's a slow thing. It grows on you, like a fungus or something of that nature, which is why I'm capable of transmitting it through the media, because I'm such a fungi. Thank you very much, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to The Vinny Eastwood Show at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. There's a listener-supported broadcast, so if you want to make sure that everybody's having a huge laugh and whatever while they're being ruthlessly criminally exterminated by ruthless criminal scum, then please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and donate or subscribe for $5 a month. month today. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again sometime. Nobody can save me now.